Carpentry, Mr. Novoselsky.
Good morning. Please support, gentlemen. If I may, I would like to concentrate on one issue which I think was crystallized by the recent motion practice. This is a case where the trial court enforcing a forum clause saying that in any disputes arising from the construction of this development were to be resolved in the courts of Mexico. Prior to the time the evidentiary hearing was scheduled, we discovered a disclosure, I believe it's a 10-K, I don't do a lot of SEC work, where Starwood, in its disclosure, which we later found some Raintree disclosures, had entered into, I call it a divorce, it was a separation agreement that separated the relationship of these two parties. On the face of the SEC disclosure,
forgive me, I've got to stop you because before, and I really am sorry, but reading the briefs, I didn't understand your assertions about the SEC filings. Are these filings part of the record?
Yes, they're at, if the court will give me just a second, I believe.
Were they submitted as discovery, or do we just have your statements to the court?
No, we've submitted, if you look at page 4182. What we did is we copied the SEC disclosure from the database. We gave it to the district court and asked for a disclosure of the settlement agreement described in the SEC annual report. I believe they call it a 10-K. According to, and I have the wording, if you look at page 3 of our reply brief, that is a verbatim description of what the SEC was told by Starwood, which said they purchased the real assets, which is the project here, a settlement of all pending and threatened legal claims, exchange of notes, and the court reading that, and this is at page 4265 of the record, says, if true, that would be relevant to the improper venue issue. This came to light when I discovered this. I asked to take the depositions, but I asked for a copy of this agreement. The argument the defendants made in the motion to treat.
What is your conception of the relationship between Raintree and DTR?
Raintree claims, well, originally in the 97 disclosure, when the Raintree and Starwood come up to Chicago to discuss at the plaintiffs' committee, they said it was a recently acquired, wholly independent Mexican company that had taken the money to build the project and, frankly, spent so much of it they couldn't build it, that Raintree and Starwood had acquired it afterwards. When you look at the original SEC disclosure, Starwood and Raintree said, we purchased this as a wholly owned subsidiary back in 97. So our position initially to the trial court is, when they come up here, they're defrauding.
I'm asking you, what is the relationship between Raintree and starting to throw in Starwood, if you want?
What is the relationship
between Raintree and DTR?
Their position is...
Asking you, what is the relationship between Raintree and DTR?
None, because according to their affidavits, it's owned by a non-party Raintree entity.
You say none. There's no relationship between them.
That's between Raintree and DTR. Yes, sir. But as for Starwood, if you look at the court's opinion, the court concedes that Starwood offered absolutely no evidence whatsoever on Starwood's relationship to DTR. It says, the opinion says, the court was given some evidence from Raintree showing a relationship between Raintree and DTR, but the exact language from the opinion says none of that relates to Starwood.
Are you talking about the 2006 settlement agreement now?
Yes. I'm also talking about the actual hearing where the court, in fact, if you look at the transcript of the hearing, when the hearing concludes, Judge Kendall looks at counsel for Starwood and says, do you have any evidence? And he says, no.
But didn't the court state, and now I'm quoting, based on the court's review of the document, that 2006 settlement agreement,
yes, ma'am,
it is not relevant to the narrow, improper venue issue now before the court.
Yes.
And disclosure to plaintiffs would be pointless. So I couldn't understand your claim that the court found the 2006 settlement document to be relevant.
We were never shown the document. We were told it's a confidential document, even though it was disclosed to the SEC. What I'm saying to the court, very frankly, is either the SEC disclosure was false or the disclosure of this agreement to the court was false, because the SEC document specifically says there was a purchase of real estate, a transfer of ownership. The court, in its opinion, says there is nothing about a transfer of ownership in the document I was given. This is an unusual case in that we were told you can't see it, even under a protective order. We were never given an opportunity to see it. So what I'm saying to the court today is Judge Kendall erred, because if you look at the SEC disclosure, which Kramer says is evidence, the SEC disclosure says we had this $41 million transfer of money, we transferred real assets, we acquired other matters. Yet the document that Judge Kendall says she reviewed, and I believe she reviewed it, there's no question she made a mistake. She's very conscientious. We believe the document she was given was not the settlement agreement. We had no way to challenge it because we were never given it to review. And, yes, I realize that there are ramifications for that, but either the SEC...
And Starwood have nothing to do with DTR. What's your claim against them?
Oh, our claim. If they own the property and they own the titles...
Well, doesn't that mean they own DTR?
No, sir. They said we didn't buy DTR. In 2006...
But DTR owned the property.
Yes, sir. But they acquired supposedly the land.
What do you mean supposedly?
According to their...
What do you think they acquired?
If I believe the 2007...
No, don't give me ifs. What do you think they acquired?
Sir, I'd be lying to you if I told you I know anything other than the disclosure. I think they actually own the property.
You're fencing with me and answer my question.
I haven't the vaguest idea based on the fact that we were not given the evidence. We were told we couldn't see the evidence.
What are the cases against Raintree and Starwood?
My case against Raintree and Starwood is they collected DTR, well, theoretically DTR. Actually, the $26 million went to a Raintree entity.
Theoretically DTR. We can't understand what you're talking about.
Sir, in the record, it is undisputed that the payment form said all of the $26 million goes to two separate Raintree entities in San Diego, California, not to DTR. I don't think DTR sold anything. So we
but
have
DTR
a...
But DTR owned the property.
We have... If they owned it, they didn't sell it because but the money went to Raintree.
I don't understand it. How did Raintree and Starwood acquire it?
They, according to them, they acquired it through their purchase of DTR, if we take
right.
them at their word.
You have it, and you think they acquired it how or from whom?
From DTR. If DTR owned the property in Mexico, even the defendants acknowledge...
Raintree and Starwood merely acquired the property but didn't have any... but was just a purchaser from DTR, and it never controlled DTR, bought DTR, or anything?
That is that is what the plaintiffs were told.
Control DTR?
That was what we were told.
Will you answer my question and stop fencing? Do you think that Raintree and Starwood controlled DTR at any point?
At some point, yes.
Look,
yes.
Help me. You entered into a contract with DTR, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
Which, after many acquisitions and mergers, God only knows what was going on there, became part of the entities of Raintree and Starwood, right?
It appears so, yes.
Then why shouldn't the contractual form selection clause not be upheld?
Because in 2006, Raintree and Starwood entered into a settlement where Starwood acquired land, the land and some money only. It told the SEC, and there's additional evidence in the record, that they did not acquire the contracts between the plaintiffs and what was DTR. So our position is if you didn't acquire the contract, you can't stand in the shoes of the contract and become rely upon a relationship which arguably is only Raintree and DTR at that point.
How would it be possible for them not to have acquired the contract? Because
presumably,
the dispute here clearly relates to the contracts.
I'll take what they said to SEC. It's true. It says to the SEC, we did not. They sent letters, in fact, not just them, Raintree also sent letters to the plaintiff saying Starwood has not acquired the contracts. It's in black and white. And yet the judge, and if you look at her opinion through 20 to 23, says, well, I have no evidence of the actual relationship between DTR and Starwood now. But I'll assume they're related because the settlement agreement I got out of the 2006 settlement is merely an exchange of debt, which is not what the SEC was told. There was no reason that we could not have seen that. It was publicly disclosed, so I think the privilege doesn't affect it. But we did give the court evidence that what the court was given was not, in fact, the settlement agreement. Otherwise, I could stand here and answer Judge Posner and you and tell you exactly how they did or didn't get the contract rights. But that was always hidden from the plaintiffs. I believe it was hidden from the trial court as well.
Did you give the district court the correct SEC filings?
Yes, we did. Never disputed. No one has ever disputed the SEC filing. In fact, in their
why
brief,
do I have a feeling that someone might in the next 3 minutes?
I'm sorry?
Why do I have a feeling that someone might in the next 3 minutes?
Well, if they do, Your Honor, it's not in their briefs. It was not in the record. No one said the – in fact, if you look at the Starwood brief, they don't say the SEC document they're referring to is wrong. They just say it's a dizzying argument and it's irrelevant. But they don't say it's wrong. In fact,
dizzying and irrelevant?
It's not my
pretty
language.
Pretty strong.
Yeah, it is. And, Judge, it's a real important issue in the sense that SEC disclosures, you have platoons of lawyers – who go through those with a fine tooth comb. My daughter's at Sidley, and at one point early in her career, she came home and was, I thought she was going to commit suicide. She was going crazy over whether to put a paragraph at the end of a sentence or the beginning. It's that complex. Yet we were told you can't see it. And the SEC disclosure and what Judge Kendall describes are two entirely different matters. And I agree with you. Somehow, how do you acquire property but not acquire a contract, but you say it explicitly? Perhaps the best thing to say is I would ask that this matter go back, that the settlement agreement should have been disclosed. It was not privileged. It was waived. We can do a protective order. Let's see what it says. Let's see what the actual relationship of these parties to DTR is.
Did you ask for any of that?
I asked for
the go-round.
When we initially,
okay.
I filed a request. I asked the defendants, can I see the contract? I want to cross-examine. I want to examine your people. They objected. I filed a timely motion before Judge Kendall. She doesn't rule on it initially other than to say, if it's true, it's relevant. In her written decision a few months later, she said, I've read it. It's just an exchange of debt.
But you never pursued discovery, right?
I did. I asked for this promptly. This is the critical document.
But you didn't dispose Mr. Beck.
Without the contract, I couldn't. Not meaningfully.
What do you mean without the contract you couldn't?
The present ownership of this property was based on the settlement. I asked to depose Beck and others with that document.
Well, if you didn't have the document, why didn't you go ahead and depose him and ask him, you know, all these questions? And if he lies, then he's in trouble, right?
How do I know if he lies, sir? I have no document to cross-examine him from.
Well, depending what you get on the deposition, You may be able to get the document.
Except the document the judge was given was completely irrelevant to our inquiry. It's simply a restructuring of debt. It has nothing to do with ownership.
You could have asked for documents that would have indicated, well, it seems to me, you could have asked for the documents that would have indicated the location of the contract formation. No.
Is it your bottom line that Raintree and Starwood, or Raintree or Starwood, they acquired DTR, but they didn't acquire the contract, which included the form selection clause? Is that what your argument comes down to?
Yes, to Starwood, yes.
Is that what your argument comes down to?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Novoselic.
Thank you.
McKee?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jim Ormiston, and I'm here on behalf of the Raintree Appellees, namely Raintree Vacation Exchange, LLC, Raintree Resorts International, Inc., and Doug Beck. Above all else, when you set aside the distractions, this case is about enforcing a contractual form selection clause, one that is in a contract signed by every one of these plaintiffs. That part is undisputed. The real issue seems to be, are the Raintree defendants and the Starwood defendants sufficiently connected to DTR, the original seller and developer, to allow the forum selection clause to be enforced? As to my clients, the Raintree appellees, I believe that the evidence in the record is overwhelming about their relationship to DTR. We submitted unrebutted declarations from Mr. Beck himself, and for Mr. Arroyo, that establish that Raintree Resorts International, Inc. owns all of the equity of two companies. Those two companies are Canarias Future SL.
Well, his argument is that you acquired DTR's assets except for its contracts.
Appellant's counsel does not understand the facts. He is guessing about that. Raintree did not acquire DTR. If it did, it was back in 1997. When this project was going on, it was already in the family of companies. We have always had a connection to DTR and have never said otherwise. And this record is devoid of any comment.
What is the significance of this disclaimer of acquisition of the contracts?
It has to do with the Starwood entities. Starwood, in 2006, purchased the real property and the development rights, but did not step into the shoes of the purchase contracts that had already been executed by certain Villas buyers and DTR. That only relates to the Starwood parties. As to the Raintree parties, nowhere in their brief do they ever state that Raintree is not entitled to enforce this form selection clause. They essentially concede that issue on appeal. And as I said before, the evidence in this case, or the record in this case, is undisputed on that issue that there is a connection, a significant connection.
Well, are you selling Starwood down the river or what?
No, I'm not, because the plaintiffs have
pled. Is that why there's a seat in between the two? I noticed that immediately.
No, Your Honor, and this is why. The plaintiffs in their complaint allege a joint venture between Raintree and Starwood. The existence, well, their pleading of that joint venture allows there to be a significant connection between the Starwood defendants so that they may also enforce the forum selection clause. Because they, in fact, became the successor developer of this project. And as the successor developer of this project, and since this lawsuit involves their purchase of these interests, and whether they're entitled to get their money back, Starwood is entitled to assert the forum selection clause. My only point was the appellants concede that Raintree has a sufficient connection to DTR to allow them to enforce the forum selection clause. They don't concede it as to Starwood. But as to my client, they don't even contend on appeal that we can't. And let me talk about the discovery issue, because I think that's important. It was discussed a lot during appellant's argument. Judge Posner was right. The plaintiffs never sought to take any discovery. They did not issue a single deposition notice. They didn't issue a single subpoena. They never even served a document request under the rules.
Well, their argument is, you know, that it was all there in the motion to compel.
They jumped right to a motion to compel, having never served any discovery. And one of the responses was to the motion to compel. They're seeking to compel responses to non-existing discovery. But Judge Kendall, she sort of fast-forwarded through all of that. And she said, okay, let me take a look at the 2006 settlement agreement. And we promptly submitted that to her for in-camera review. She looked at it and made the determination that it was not relevant to the very narrow venue issue that was before her. And I think this is significant. The appellants, if they wanted the 2006 settlement agreement to be a subject of this appeal, they should have filed some sort of motion in the trial court to make that in-camera document part of this record on appeal. But they didn't do that. And so there's no way for this panel to do the same thing Judge Kendall did, which was look at the 2006 settlement agreement and make your own independent determination of whether it's relevant or not. But Judge Kendall, who's the trial judge, she's the one that calls those balls and strikes, she looked at it, and she found very clearly that it was not relevant to the very narrow issue that was before her on the venue motion. And I've said this before, but there are a lot of rabbit trails in this case. But when we come back to what the central issue is we have a very clear and express forum selection clause. Starting with the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Bremen and many, many opinions by this circuit, including Hugel and American Patriot and AAR International, courts routinely enforce forum selection clauses. And they give us three ways that a party resisting those clauses can get around them. If they were procured by fraud, if against public policy, or if it would deny the plaintiff, is so unjust that it would deny the plaintiff a day in court. Significantly, they don't attack the forum selection clause on appeal on any of those three grounds. There's plenty of law out there about how you get around a forum selection clause. They chose not to even attack it on those grounds. They attack it on the scope issue, which is what we've been talking about most of the time. Does the scope of their claims fall within the forum selection clause? And keep in mind that in this case, they only assert a single fraud cause of action. And they do so, we think, to avoid the effect of the forum selection clause. But as we point out to the court, there's numerous cases that say a plaintiff cannot avoid the effect of a forum selection clause by artfully choosing to only plead certain causes of action and not plead others. Because the gravamen of their claim here is we bought an interest in a Mexican timeshare project and we didn't get what we paid for. And so the case has to arise from or concern that contract. In fact, the language itself, the paragraph 12, the forum selection clause, says it applies to any controversy on the interpretation and compliance with the rights and obligations of this agreement. What is this case if it's not about the compliance with their purchase of the timeshare interest? That's what it always comes back to. The second way they try to attack it is to say that Judge Kendall's, quote, acceptance of the forum selection clause was not reasonable. And I'm not sure what they mean by acceptance. I assume that they're trying to say that it is somehow unreasonable under the circumstances. Well, again, they didn't provide the trial court or this court with any evidence to support that. They do not argue that the forum selection clause was procured by fraud. In fact, their complaint including their amended complaint, which was filed after the venue issue had been teed up, doesn't even mention this forum selection clause. If they wanted to attack it, you would have think that they would have pled something in their complaint that it was procured by fraud or undue influence. The language of the forum selection clause is mandatory. And when you have mandatory language like that, it waives any right to argue that the forum is inconvenient. And that's especially true in international contracts. And they also do not argue that the enforcement of the forum selection clause would contravene any public policy of this forum. The court knows that one of the side issues, one of the distractions that the appellants introduce is whether or not the district court properly considered the declarations that were submitted in support of the motion to dismiss. That issue hasn't come up, but I want to say that is an abuse of discretion standard. And in order for the plaintiffs to prevail there, they have to show that Judge Kendall's review of those declarations was so far out of bounds as to cause actual and substantial prejudice to them, or that it was not relevant at all and completely arbitrary to the issue before her. The only way they try to do that, Your Honors, is by alleging, without any support in this record, without any cite to any part of the evidence that was submitted, that certain statements in those declarations were untrue. I submit to the court that those arguments are based on their inability to understand and synthesize the facts before them. One of the questions earlier was about the SEC filings. I want to point out that Raintree is not a public company. The SEC filings from Raintree were made back in 2001 and 2002 when Raintree had, for a brief period of time, some publicly traded debt obligations, which required Raintree to make some SEC filings for a certain period of time. But back in 2001 and 2002, this project that we're talking about in this case hadn't even begun. The plaintiffs purchased their interests in this timeshare project between 2004 and 2006. So when they're complaining about or making arguments or making conjecture and speculation about Raintree's SEC filings, those were filed years before the project at issue even was started.
So were they the wrong SEC filings to have been handed over?
Well, as for Raintree, yes, but we didn't hand over anything. As I said before, there was no discovery.
They brought it in.
They looked it up on the Internet and brought it in and claim that it was somehow relevant or claim that it's inconsistent with the other evidence. I submit as to Raintree, the 2001-2002 SEC filings, they have nothing to do with the project that we're here about. They're not inconsistent with anything that was submitted in support of Raintree's motion. Let me conclude by stating that there's an alternate grounds that this judgment can be affirmed on behalf of the Raintree defendants. The Raintree defendants moved at the trial court for dismissal for lack of personal jurisdiction. The plaintiffs below conceded that Raintree was not subject to general jurisdiction in Illinois and instead relied specifically on specific personal jurisdiction. Because they went down the specific personal jurisdiction ground, they were required, once we submitted evidence that Raintree did not have sufficient contacts, which we did, they were required to bring evidence that each plaintiff had facts that would support specific jurisdiction as to each plaintiff against each Raintree defendant. The plaintiffs submitted a single affidavit from one of the 250 plaintiffs. I would submit that single affidavit doesn't even establish specific jurisdiction as to that one plaintiff. But it surely does not establish any specific personal jurisdiction as to the 249 plaintiffs who didn't submit any evidence in support of jurisdiction in Illinois. And on that alternative grounds, we would request that this court affirm the trial court's judgment in all respects.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Mr. Armiston. Mr. McKee?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Patrick Mackey on behalf of the Starwood Appellees, Starwood Vacation Ownership, Inc., and Starwood Hotels and Resorts Worldwide, Inc. I'm going to be brief. I believe I reserved only 5 minutes. I'm going to rely primarily on the briefs for a number of the issues that we're addressing here today. However,
before you do that, could I ask a question, please?
Sure.
Because what I was wondering was about those statements from Starwood in an email to one of the plaintiffs, and I'll quote, we were not able to purchase the contracts that were sold prior to the acquisition in December. What does that mean for the contractual relationship between Starwood and the plaintiffs?
What that means, Your Honor, is that Starwood was able to acquire the property and the development rights for the project at issue. So it was not the contracts, but Starwood did undertake the development rights relating to the project at issue. If I could, Your Honor, and this is one of the red herrings.
Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Novoselsky is correct.
In what, Your Honor?
About the contract situation.
That Starwood did not obtain or purchase the contracts? He is correct in that, Your Honor. There was never a dispute in that, Your Honor. What Starwood is contending is that it's closely related enough to the project itself and that it's closely related enough to the undertakings that were undertaken by DTR and then subsequently undertaken by Raintree, and that in this acquisition, in addition to purchasing the property rights, it also purchased the development rights and the development obligations relating to this project. Therefore, it's able to rely on the form selection clause contained in the contracts and the purchase agreements.
So you think that reference to not obtaining contracts was just the contracts between the individual buyers and DTR? Or?
That's exactly what it was, Your Honor. It was the individual contracts that DTR sold to the individual purchasers. However, Starwood did obtain the property and the development rights for the project at issue.
And so by osmosis, it also obtained the contract?
Well, Your Honor, the contract isn't necessary for Starwood to step into the shoes and argue that this matter should be sent to Mexico pursuant to the form selection clause. The case law out there, decided by this court, specifically the Hagel case and the Refco case, state that all Starwood needs to be is closely related to either one of the parties that was a party to the contract, in other words, DTR and then subsequently Raintree, or closely related enough to the subject matter of the litigation. And as plaintiffs have alleged, the plaintiffs have alleged that Starwood, Raintree, and DTR were all part of a joint venture to defraud the plaintiffs. So that's all that's needed for Starwood to rely on the form selection clause.
Okay,
thank you, Mr. Mackey.
Thank you, Judge.
So, Mr. Novoselsky, you have anything further?
Yes. The form selection clause, as Mr. Ormiston has told you, is part of each contract between the plaintiff and originally DTR. He also pointed out that Starwood didn't acquire it. Counsel for Starwood said, we did not acquire your client's contracts, which means they did not acquire the forum selection clause. They're now arguing that the judge had sufficient evidence in front of her to assume they were closely related. However, they offered, and I'll go back to the opinion, no evidence whatsoever. They stood mute. They said, we stand on Raintree's material. In her opinion, she said there is nothing in the Raintree documents that addresses Starwood's current rights. In 2006, whatever the relationship between Starwood and Raintree, by what you were told today, stopped. It ended. They entered into a new contractual relationship. Part of that separated my client's contracts, and in theory, my client's rights, and Starwood. So Mr. Ormiston said maybe we're abandoning them. Perhaps we are. However, there is no question that Judge Kendall had no evidence. They're the moving party. They had to show Judge Kendall their right to stand in this, whether related or not. I'll go to exactly what she said. We were given no evidence by Starwood whatsoever. No, they didn't even argue to her. They didn't say to her. Interestingly enough, they didn't say the disclosure you got, which is different than our admitted 2007 disclosure. They are a publicly traded company. They never said it's accurate. They said not a word. I don't even know if they saw it because it was submitted, as Mr. Ormison correctly points out, by Raintree, which is why that contract, if the court was going to rely on it, or if we could take discovery on it, which we did, we promptly asked for the discovery. We wanted that contract. The request for deposition said everything related to that 2006 severance, because that affects, when we were in front of the court in 2011, the status of whether they could stand in the shoes of what they now tell you they concede. We did not purchase the forum clause because we did not purchase the contract, which is why I asked repeatedly for it. I asked you to go no further than the court's opinion. No documents, no nothing. So okay. On that basis, I'd request relief at a minimum as to Starwood.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Novoselsky, and thank you, Mr. Armiston and Mr. Mackey.